but he'd envied those people and their ease, their comfortable home, their comfort with each other. He knew he asked Nina too often, but as they disembarked near East Stave, Matthias couldn't stop himself from saying, "How do you feel?"
"Quite well,"
she said dismissively, adjusting her veil. She was dressed in the glittering blue finery of the Lost Bride, the same costume she'd been wearing the night she and the other members of the dregs had appeared in his cell.
"Tell me, Druskella, have you ever actually been to this part of the barrel?"
"I didn't have much opportunity for sightseeing while I was in Hellgate," Matthias said, "and I wouldn't have come here anyway."
"Of course not. This many people having fun in one place might have shocked the Fjärden right out of you."
"Nina," Matthias said quietly as they made their way to the Furrier. He didn't want to push, but he needed to know. "When we went after Smeet, you used a wig and cosmetics. Why didn't you tailor yourself?" She shrugged.
"It was easier and faster."
Matthias was silent, unsure of whether to press her further. They passed a cheese shop, and Nina sighed.
"How can I walk by a window full of wheels of cheese and feel nothing? I don't even know myself anymore."
She paused, then said,
"I tried to tailor myself. Something feels off, different. I only managed the circles under my eyes, and it took every bit of my focus."
"But you were never a gifted tailor."
"Manners, Fjärden."
"Nina."
"This was different. It wasn't just challenging, it was painful. It's hard to explain."
"What about compelling behaviors?" Matthias asked. "The way you did at the ice court when you used the Parem."
"I don't think it's possible anymore."
"Have you tried?"
"Not exactly."
"Try it on me."
"Matthias, we have work to do."
"Try it."
"I'm not going to go rattling around in your head when we don't know what might happen."
"Nina."
"Fine," she said in exasperation. "Come here."
They had nearly reached East Stave, and the crowds of revelers had grown thicker. Nina pulled him into an alley between two buildings. She lifted his mask and her own veil. Then, slowly, she placed a hand on either side of his face. Her fingers slid into his hair, and Matthias's focus shattered. It felt like she was touching him everywhere. She looked into his eyes.
"Well?"
"I don't feel anything,"
he said. His voice sounded embarrassingly hoarse. She arched a brow.
"Nothing?"
"What did you try to make me do?"
"I'm trying to compel you to kiss me."
"That's foolish."
"Why is that?"
"Because I always want to kiss you," he admitted.
"Then how come you never do?"
"Nina, you just went through a terrible ordeal."
"I did. That's true. You know what would help? A lot of kissing. We haven't been alone since we were aboard the Farallon."
"You mean when you almost died?" said Matthias. Someone had to remember the gravity of this situation.
"I prefer to think of the good times. Like when you held my hair as I was vomiting into a bucket."
"Stop trying to make me laugh."
"But I like your laugh."
"Nina, this is not the time to flirt."
"I need to catch you off your guard. Otherwise, you're too busy protecting me and asking me if I'm okay."
"Is it wrong to worry?"
"No. It's wrong to treat me like I might break apart at any moment. I'm not that fine or that fragile."
She shoved his mask down none too gently, yanked her veil back in place, and strode past him out of the alley, across the street, to a shop with a golden badger over the door. He followed. He knew he'd said the wrong thing, but he had no idea what the right thing was. A little bell rang as they entered the shop.
"How can this place be open at such hours?" he murmured. "Who wants to buy a coat in the dead of night?"
"Tourists."
And in fact, a few people were browsing the stacks and furs and pelts. Matthias followed Nina to the counter.
"We're picking up an order," she said to the bespectacled clerk.
"The name?"
"Judith Conan."
"Ah,"
the clerk said, consulting a ledger.
"Golden Lynx and Black Bear paid in full. Just a moment."
He vanished into the back room and emerged a minute later, struggling beneath the weight of two huge parcels wrapped in brown paper and tied with twine.
"Do you need help getting these to—"
"We're fine." Matthias hefted the packages with little effort. The people of the city needed more fresh air and exercise.
"But it may rain. At least let me—"
"We're fine," Matthias growled, and the clerk took a step backward.
"Ignore him," Nina said. "He needs a nap. Thank you so much for your help."
The clerk smiled weakly, and they were on their way.
"You know you're terrible at this, right?"
Nina asked once they were on the street and entering East Stave.
"At lies and deception?"
"At being polite,"
Matthias considered.
"I didn't mean to be rude."
"Just let me do the talking."
"Nina."
"No names from here on out."
She was vexed with him. He could hear it in her voice, and he didn't think it was because he'd been short with the clerk. They paused only so that Matthias could exchange his madman's costume for one of the many Mr. Crimson ensembles folded into the packages from the furrier. Matthias wasn't sure if the clerk had known what was stuffed in the brown paper wrapping, if the costumes had been made in the shop, or if the golden badger was just some kind of drop spot. Kaz had mysterious connections throughout Ketterdam, and only he knew the truth of their workings. Once Matthias found a large enough red cloak and placed a red and white lacquered mask over his face, Nina handed him a bag of silver coins. Matthias bounced the bag once in his palm, and the coins gave a cheerful jingle.
"They aren't real, are they?"
"Of course not. But no one ever knows if the coins are real. That's part of the fun. Let's practice."
"Practice?"
"Mother, father, pay the rent,"
Nina said in a sing-song voice. Matthias stared at her.
"Is it possible you're running a fever?"
Nina shoved her veil up onto her head so he could experience the full force of her glare.
"It's from the Comédie Brute. When Mr. Crimson comes on stage, the audience shouts,
'Mother, father, pay the rent,'" Matthias finished.
"Exactly. Then you say, 'I can't, my dear, the money's spent,' and you toss a handful of coins into the crowd."
"Why?"
"The same reason everyone hisses at the madman and throws flowers at the Scarab Queen. It's tradition. Tourists don't always get it, but the Kirch do. So tonight, if someone yells, 'Mother, father, pay the rent,'"
"I can't, my dear, the money's spent,"
Matthias intoned gloomily, casting a handful of coins into the air.
"You have to do it with more enthusiasm," Nina urged. "It's supposed to be fun."
"I feel foolish."
"It's good to feel foolish sometimes, Fjärden."
"You only say that because you have no shame."
To his surprise, instead of offering a sharp retort, she went silent and remained that way. Until they took up their first position in front of a gambling parlor on the lid, joining the musicians and buskers, only a few doors down from Club Cumulus. Then, it was as if someone had flipped a switch in Nina.
"Come one, come all, to the Crimson Cutlass," she declared. "You there, sir. You're too skinny for your own good. What would you think of a little free food and a flagon of wine? And you, miss, now you look like you know how to have a bit of fun."
Nina lured tourists to them one by one, as if she'd been born to it, offering free food and drink and handing out costumes and flyers. When one of the bouncers from the gambling parlor emerged to see what they were up to, they moved along, heading south and west, continuing to give away the 200 costumes and masks Kaz had procured. When people asked what it was all about, Nina claimed it was a promotion for a new gambling hall called the Crimson Cutlass. As Nina had predicted, occasionally someone would spot Matthias's costume and shriek,
"Mother, father, pay the rent!"
Dutifully, Matthias replied, doing his best to sound jolly. If the tourists and revelers found his performance lacking, no one said so, possibly distracted by the showers of silver coin. By the time they reached West Stave, the stacks of costumes were gone and the sun was rising. He caught a brief flash from the roof of the Ambers Hotel, Jesper signaling with his mirror. Matthias escorted Nina up to the room reserved for Judith Conan on the third floor of the hotel. Just as Kaz had said, the balcony had a perfect view of the wide expanse of Godmed Bridge and the waters of West Stave, bordered on both sides by hotels and pleasure houses.
What does that mean? Matthias asked. Godmed Bridge.
Good Maiden Bridge.
Why is it called that?
Nina leaned against the doorway and said,
Well, the story is that when a woman found out her husband had fallen in love with a girl from West Stave and planned to leave her, she came to the bridge and, rather than live without him, hurled herself into the canal.
Over a man with so little honor?
You'd never be tempted? All the fruits and flesh of West Stave before you?
Would you throw yourself off a bridge for a man who was?
I wouldn't throw myself off a bridge for the King of Ravka.
It's a terrible story, said Matthias.
I doubt it's true. It's just what happens when you let men name the bridges.
You should rest, he said. I can wake you when it's time.
I'm not tired, and I don't need to be told how to do my job.
You're angry.
Or told how I feel. Get to your post, Matthias. You're looking a little ragged around those gilded edges, too.
Her voice was cold, her spine straight. The memory of the dream came at him so hard he could almost feel the bite of the wind, the snow lashing his cheeks in stinging gusts. His throat burned, scraped raw as he shouted Nina's name. He wanted to tell her to be careful. He wanted to ask her what was wrong.
No mourners, he murmured.
No funerals,
she replied, her eyes trained on the bridge. Matthias left quietly, descended the stairs, and crossed over the canal via the wide expanse of Godmed Bridge. He looked up at the balcony of the Ambers Hotel, but saw no sign of Nina. That was good. If he couldn't see her from the bridge, then Van Eck wouldn't be able to either. A few stone steps took him down to a dock where a flower seller was poling his barge full of blossoms into place in the rosy wash of morning light. Matthias exchanged a brief word with the man as he tended to his tulips and daffodils, noting the marks Weiland had chalked above the waterline on both sides of the canal. They were ready. He made his way up the stairs of the Emporium Comédie, surrounded on all sides by masks and veils and glittering capes. Every floor had a different theme, offering fantasies of all kinds. He was horrified to see a rack of Druskala costumes. Still, it was a good place to avoid notice. He hurried to the roof and signaled to Jesper with his mirror. They were all in position now. Just before noon, Weiland would descend to wait in the canalside cafe that always drew a noisy collection of street performers, musicians, mimes, jugglers, busking for tourist money. For now, the boy lay on his side, tucked beneath the stone ledge of the roof and dozing lightly. Matthias's rifle lay bundled in oilcloth beside Weiland, and he'd set out a whole string of fireworks, their fuses curled like mice tails. Matthias settled his back against the ledge and shut his eyes, floating in and out of consciousness. He was used to these long stretches with little sleep from his time with the Druskala. He would wake when he needed to, but now he marched across the ice, the wind howling in his ears. Even the Ravkins had a name for that wind. Gruzburia, the brute, a killing wind. It came from the north, a storm that engulfed everything in its path. Soldiers died mere steps from their tents, lost in the whiteness, their cries for help eaten by the faceless cold. Nina was out there. He knew it, and he had no way to reach her. He screamed her name again and again, feeling his feet going numb in his boots, the ice seeping through his clothes. He strained to hear an answer, but his ears were full of the roar of the storm and, somewhere in the distance, the howl of wolves. She would die on the ice. She would die alone, and it would be his fault. He woke, gasping. The sun was high in the sky. Weiland stood above him, shaking him gently.
It's almost time.
Matthias nodded and rose, rolling his shoulders, feeling the warm spring air of Ketterdam around him. It felt alien in his lungs.
Are you all right?
Weiland asked tentatively, but apparently Matthias's glower was answer enough.
You're great, Weiland said, and hurried down the stairs.
Matthias consulted the cheap brass watch Kaz had acquired for him. Almost 12 bells. He hoped Nina had rested more easily than he had. He flashed his mirror once at her balcony and felt a surge of relief when a bright light flashed back at him. He signaled to Jesper, then leaned over the roof's ledge to wait. Matthias knew Kaz had chosen West Stave for its anonymity and its crowds. Already its denizens had started to come awake again after the previous evening's revels. The servants who tended to the needs of their various houses were doing their shopping, accepting shipments of wine and fruit for the next night's activities. Tourists who had just arrived in the city were strolling down both sides of the canal, pointing to the elaborately decorated signs that marked each house, some famous, some notorious. He could see a many-petaled rose fashioned in white wrought iron and gilded with silver. The House of the White Rose. Nina had worked there for nearly a year. He'd never questioned her about her time there. He had no right. She had stayed in the city to help him, and she could do as she wished. And yet he'd been unable to keep from imagining her there, the curves of her body laid bare. Green eyes, heavy-lidded. Cream-colored petals caught in the dark waves of her hair. There were nights when he imagined her beckoning him closer. Others when it was someone else she welcomed in the dark. And he'd lie awake, wondering if it would be jealousy or desire that drove him mad first. He tore his eyes from the sign and pulled a long glass from his pocket, forcing himself to scan the rest of the stave. Just a few minutes before noon, Matthias caught sight of Kaz advancing from the west, his dark shape a blot moving through the crowd, his cane keeping time with his uneven gait. The crowd seemed to part around him, perhaps sensing the purpose that drove him. He reminded Matthias of villagers making signs in the air to ward off evil spirits. Alice Van Eck waddled along beside him. Her blindfold had been removed, and through his long glass, Matthias could see her lips moving. Sweet Joe, is she still singing? Judging from the sour expression on Kaz's face, it was a distinct possibility. Beyond the other side of the bridge, Matthias saw Van Eck approach. He held himself rigidly, his posture erect, arms kept tight to his body, as if he feared that the sin-rich air of the barrel would stain his suit. Kaz had been clear. Taking out Van Eck was a last resort. They didn't want to kill a member of the Merchant Council, not in broad daylight in front of witnesses. "Wouldn't it be cleaner?" Jesper asked. "A heart attack? A brain fever?" Matthias would have preferred an honest kill, an open battle. But that was not the way things were done in Ketterdam. "He can't suffer if he's dead," Kaz had said, and that had been the end of it. The Demjin brooked no argument. Van Eck had come surrounded by guards dressed in the gold and red livery of his house. Their heads swiveled left and right, taking in their surroundings, looking for threats. From the hang of their coats, Matthias could tell they were all armed. But there, surrounded by three huge guards, was a tiny hooded figure. Inej. Matthias was surprised at the gratitude that flooded him. Though he'd only known the little Suli girl for a short while, he'd admired her courage from the first, and she'd saved their lives multiple times, putting herself at risk to do so. He'd questioned many of his choices, but never his commitment to seeing her freed from Van Eck. He only wished she'd separate herself from Kaz Brekker. The girl deserved better. Then again, maybe Nina deserved better than Matthias. Both parties reached the bridge. Kaz and Alice walked forward. Van Eck signaled the guards holding an edge. Matthias looked up. From the other rooftop, Jesper's mirror was flashing frantically. Matthias scanned the area around the bridge, but he couldn't see what had gotten Jesper so panicked. He peered through the long glass, training it on the labyrinthine streets that flowed outward from both sides of the stave. Kaz's retreat appeared clear, but when Matthias looked past Van Eck to the east, his heart filled with dread. The streets were dotted with clusters of purple, all of them moving toward the stave. Stodwatch. Was it just a coincidence or something Van Eck had planned? Surely he couldn't want to risk city officials finding out what he'd been up to. Could the Fjerdens be involved? What if they were coming to arrest both Van Eck and Kaz? Matthias flashed his mirror twice at Nina. From her lower vantage point, she wouldn't see the Stadtwatch until it was too late. Again, he felt the cold lash of the wind, heard his voice calling her name, felt his terror rise as no answer came. "She'll be fine," he told himself. "She's a warrior." But Jesper's warning ran in his ears. "Be careful. She's not quite herself." He hoped Kaz was ready. He hoped Nina was stronger than she seemed. He hoped the plans they'd laid were enough, that Jesper's aim was true, that Wyland's calculations were correct. Trouble was coming for them all. Matthias reached for his rifle.
9. Kaz. Kaz's first thought when he glimpsed Van Eck moving toward Goedmid Bridge was, "This man should never play cards." His second was that someone had broken the merch's nose. It was crooked and swollen, a dark circle of bruising forming beneath one eye. Kaz suspected a university medic had treated the worst of the damage, but without a Grisha healer, there was only so much you could do to hide a break like that. Van Eck was trying to keep his expression neutral, but he was working so hard to look impassive that his high forehead was shiny with sweat. His shoulders were fixed stiffly, and his chest jutted forward, as if someone had attached a string to his sternum and yanked him upward. He walked onto Goedmid Bridge at a stately pace, surrounded by liveried guards in red and gold. Now that surprised Kaz. He'd thought Van Eck would prefer to enter the barrel with as little pomp as possible. He turned this new information over in his mind. It was dangerous to ignore the details. No man liked to be shown up, and for all his attempts at a dignified promenade, Van Eck's vanity had to be wounded. A merch prided himself on his business sense, his ability to strategize, to manipulate men and markets. He'd be looking to get a bit of his own back after having his hand forced by a lowly barrel thug. Kaz let his eyes pass over the guards once, briefly, searching for Inej. She was hooded, barely visible between the men Van Eck had brought, but he would have recognized that knife-edge posture anywhere. And if the temptation was there to crane his neck, to look closer, to make sure she was unharmed, he could acknowledge it, set it aside. He would not break his focus. For the briefest moment, Kaz and Van Eck sized each other up from across the bridge. Kaz couldn't help but be reminded of when they'd faced each other this way 7 days ago. He'd thought too much about that meeting. Late at night, when the day's work was done, he'd lain awake taking apart every moment of it. Again and again, Kaz thought of those few crucial seconds when he'd let his attention shift to Inej instead of keeping his eyes on Van Eck. It wasn't a mistake he could afford to make again. That boy had betrayed his weakness in a single glance, had ceded the war for the sake of a single battle, and put Inej, all of them, in danger. He was a wounded animal who needed to be put down, and Kaz had done it gladly, choked the life from him without pause for regret. The Kaz that remained saw only the job. Free Inej. Make Van Eck pay. The rest was useless noise. He'd thought about Van Eck's mistakes on Velgaluk, too. The merger had been stupid enough to trumpet the fact that his precious heir was cooking in the womb of his new wife. Young Alice Van Eck, with her milk-white hair and dumpling hands. He'd been goaded by pride, but also by his hatred for Wylan, his desire to clear his son from the books like a failed business venture. Kaz and Van Eck exchanged the shortest of nods. Kaz kept a gloved hand on Alice's shoulder. He doubted she would try to run off. But who knew what ideas were pinging around in the girl's head? Then Van Eck signaled to his men to bring Inej forward, and Kaz and Alice started across the bridge. In the blink of an eye, Kaz took in Inej's odd gait, the way she held her arms behind her back. They'd bound her hands and shackled her ankles. "A reasonable precaution," he told himself. "I'd have done the same thing." But he felt that flint inside him, scraping against the hollow places, ready to ignite into rage. He thought again about simply killing Van Eck. Patience, he reminded himself. He'd practiced it early and often. Patience would bring all his enemies to their knees in time. Patience, and the money he intended to take off this merch scum. "Do you think he's handsome?" Alice asked. "What?" Cass said, unsure he had heard her correctly. She'd been humming and singing all the way from the market where Kaz had removed her blindfold, and he'd been doing his best to tune her out. "Something has happened to Jan's nose," Alice said. "I suspect he caught a bad case of the Wraith." Alice wrinkled her own small nose, considering. "I think Jan would be handsome if he were not quite so old." "Lucky for you, we live in a world where men can make up for being old by being rich." "It would be nice if he were both young and rich." "Why stop there? How about young, rich, and royal? Why settle for a merch when you could have a prince?"
"I suppose," said Alice. "But it's the money that's important. I've never really seen the point in princes."
"Well, no one would ever doubt this girl was Kirch born and raised." "Alice, I'm shocked to find you and I are in agreement." Kaz monitored the periphery of the bridge as they drew closer to the center, keeping a careful eye on Van Eck's guards, noting the open doors on the third-floor balcony at the Ambers Hotel, the flower barge parked below the west side of the bridge as it was every morning. He assumed Van Eck would have people positioned in the surrounding buildings just as he did, but none of them would be permitted to land a kill shot. No doubt Van Eck would love to see him floating face down in a canal, but Kaz could lead Van Eck to Kuwait, and that knowledge should keep him from taking a bullet to the skull. They stopped a good 10 paces apart. Alice tried to step forward, but Kaz held her firmly in place.
"You said you were bringing me to Jan," she objected.
"And here you are," Kaz said. "Now be still."
"Jan!"
she yelled sharply.
"It's me!"
"I know, my dear," Van Eck said calmly,
his gaze locked on Kaz. He lowered his voice.
"This isn't over, Brekker. I want Kuwei Yulbo."
"Are we here to repeat ourselves? You want the secret to Jirda Perem and I want my money. The deal is the deal."
"I don't have 30 million Kruger to part with."
"Isn't that a shame? I'm sure someone else does."
"And have you had any luck securing a new buyer?"
"Don't trouble yourself on my account, Merch. The market will provide. Do you want your wife back? Or did I drag poor Alice here for nothing?"
"Just a moment," said Van Eck. "Alice, what are we naming the child?"
"Very good," Kaz said. His team had passed off Weiland as Kuwei Yulbo on Velgaluk, and Van Eck had been well fooled. Now the merch wanted confirmation he was actually getting his wife, and not some girl with a radically tailored face and a false belly. "Seems an old dog can learn a new trick. Besides rolling over." Van Eck ignored him.
"Alice?"
he repeated.
"What name are we giving the child?"
"The baby?"
replied Alice in confusion.
"Jan, if it's a boy. Plumia, if it's a girl."
"We agreed Plumia is what you're naming your new parakeet."
Alice's lip juttered out.
"I never agreed."
"Oh, I think Plumia is a lovely name for a girl," said Kaz.
"Satisfied, Merch?"
"Come," Van Eck said, ushering Alice forward as he signaled to the guard holding Inej to release her. As Inej passed Van Eck, she turned her face to him and murmured something. Van Eck's lips pinched. Inej shuffled forward, somehow graceful, even with her arms bound behind her and shackles around her ankles. 10 feet. 5 feet. Van Eck embraced Alice as she let loose a stream of questions and chatter. 3 feet. Inej's gaze was steady. She was thinner. Her lips were chapped. But despite long days in captivity, the sun caught the dark gleam of her hair beneath her hood. 2 feet. And then she was before him. They still needed to get clear of the bridge. Van Eck would not let them go this easily.
"Your knives?" he asked.
"They're packed inside my coat."
Van Eck had released Alice, and she was being led away by his guards. Those red and gold uniforms still bothered Kaz. Something was off.
"Let's get out of here," he said, an oyster knife in his hand to see to her ropes.
Mr. Brekker,
Van Eck said. Kaz heard the excitement in Van Eck's voice and froze. Maybe the man was better at bluffing than he'd given him credit for.
You gave me your word, Kaz Brekker!
Van Eck shouted in theatrical tones. Everyone within earshot on the stave turned to stare.
You swore you would return my wife and son to me! Where are you keeping Wylan?
And then Kaz saw them. A tide of purple moving toward the bridge. Stodwatch flooding into the stave, rifles raised, cudgels drawn. Kaz lifted a brow. The merch was finally making it interesting.
Sail off the bridge!
One of them shouted. Kaz glanced over his shoulder and saw more Stodwatch officers blocking their retreat. Van Eck grinned.
Shall we play for real now, Mr. Brekker? The might of my city against your band of thugs?
Kaz didn't bother to answer. He shoved Inez's shoulder, and she spun around, offering her wrist so he could slash through her bonds. He tossed the knife in the air, trusting her to catch it as he knelt to deal with her shackles, his picks already sliding between his fingers. Kaz heard the clump of boots approaching, felt Inez bend backward over his kneeling form, and heard a soft whoosh, then the sound of a body falling. The lock gave beneath Kaz's fingers and the shackles fell free. He rose, whirled, saw one Stodwatch officer down, the shaft of the oyster knife protruding from between his eyes, and more purple uniforms rushing toward them from all directions. He raised his cane to signal Jesper. West Side Flower Boat, he said to Inez. That was all it took. She leapt onto the railing of the bridge and vanished over the side without a second guess. The first set of fireworks exploded overhead, pale color in the noon light. The plan was in motion. Kaz yanked a loop of climbing line from inside his pocket and hooked it to the rail. He snagged the head of his cane on the railing beside it, hauled himself up, and vaulted over the side, his momentum carrying him out above the canal. The cord snapped taut, and he arced back toward the bridge like a pendulum, dropping onto the deck of the flower barge beside Inez. Two Stodwatch boats were already moving toward them, quickly, as more officers raced down the ramps to the canal. Kaz hadn't known what Van Eck would try. He certainly hadn't expected him to bring the Stodwatch into it, but he'd been sure Van Eck would attempt to close off all their escape routes. Another series of booms sounded, and bursts of pink and green exploded in the sky above the stave. The tourists cheered. They didn't seem to notice that two of the explosions had come from the canal and had blown holes in the prow of one of the Stodwatch boats, sending men scurrying for the sides and into the canal as the craft sank. Nicely done, Wylan. He'd bought them time, and done it without panicking the bystanders on the stave. Kaz wanted the crowd in a very good mood. He heaved a flat of wild geraniums into the canal over the protests of the flower seller and grabbed the clothes Matthias had stashed there earlier that morning. He swept the red cloak around Inez's shoulders in a rain of petals and blossoms as she continued to strap on her knives. She looked almost as startled as the flower seller. What? He asked as he tossed her a Mr. Crimson mask that matched his own. Those were my mother's favorite flower. Good to know Van Eck didn't cure you of sentiment. Nice to be back, Kaz. Good to have you back, Wraith. Ready? Wait, he said, listening. The fireworks had ceased, and a moment later, he heard the sound he'd been waiting for. The musical tinkle of coins hitting the pavement, followed by shrieks of delight from the crowd. Now, he said. They grabbed the cord and he gave a sharp tug. With a high-pitched whir, the cord retracted, yanking them upward in a burst of speed. They were back on the bridge in moments, but the scene awaiting them was decidedly different from the one they'd escaped less than 2 minutes before. West Stave was in chaos. Mr. Crimsons were everywhere, 50, 60, 70 of them in red masks and cloaks, tossing coins into the air as tourists and locals alike pushed and shoved, laughing and shouting, crawling on hands and knees, completely oblivious to the Stodwatch officers trying to get past them.
"Mother, father, pay the rent!"
shouted a crowd of girls from the doorway of the Blue Iris.
"I can't, my dear! The money's spent!"
the Mr. Crimsons chorused back and tossed another cloud of coins into the air, sending the crowd into freshly delirious shrieks of joy.
"Clear the way!"
shouted the captain of the guard. One of the officers tried to unmask a Mr. Crimson standing by a lamppost, and the crowd began booing. Kaz and Inej plunged into the swirl of red capes and people scrambling for coins. To his left, he heard Inej laugh behind her mask. He never heard her laugh like that. Giddy and wild. Suddenly, a deep, thunderous boom shook the stave. People toppled, grabbed at one another, at walls, at whatever was closest. Kaz almost lost his footing, righted himself with his cane. When he looked up, it was like trying to peer through a thick veil. Smoke hung heavy in the air. Kaz's ears were ringing. As if from a great distance, he heard frightened screams, cries of terror. A woman ran past him, face and hair coated in dust and plaster like a pantomime ghost, hands clapped over her ears. There was blood trickling from beneath her palms. A gaping hole had been blown in the facade of the House of the White Rose. He saw Inej lift her mask, and he pulled it back down over her face. He shook his head. Something was wrong. He'd planned a friendly riot, not a mass disaster, and Weiland wasn't the type to miscalculate so gravely. Someone else had come to make trouble on West Stave. Someone who didn't mind doing more than a little damage. All Kaz knew was he'd invested a lot of time and money in getting his wraith back. He sure as hell wasn't going to lose her again. He touched Inej's shoulder briefly. That was all the signal they needed. He raced for the nearest alleyway. He didn't have to look to know she was beside him, silent, sure-footed. She could have outpaced him in an instant, but they ran in tandem, matching each other step for step.
10. Jesper. Now this was Jesper's kind of chaos. Jesper had two jobs. One, before the exchange of hostages, and one after. While Inej was in Vanek's possession, Nina was the first line of defense if the guards tried to remove her from the bridge or anyone threatened her. Jesper was to keep Vanek in his rifle sights. No kill shots. But if the guy started brandishing a gun, Jesper was allowed to leave him without the use of an arm. Or two. Vanek's going to pull something, Kaz had said back on Black Veil. And it's going to be messy, because he has less than 12 hours to plan it. Good, said Jesper. Bad, said Kaz. The more complicated a plan is, the more people he has to involve. The more people talk, the more ways it can go wrong. It's a law of systems, Weiland murmured. You build in safeguards for failures, but something in the safeguards ends up causing an unforeseen failure. Vanek's move won't be elegant, but it will be unpredictable, so we need to be prepared. How do we prepare for the unpredictable? Weiland asked. We broaden our options. We keep every possible avenue of escape open. Rooftops, streets and alleys, waterways. There's no chance Vanek is going to let us stroll off that bridge. Jesper had seen trouble coming a ways off when he'd spotted the groups of Stadwatch headed for the bridge. It could just be a rousting. That happened once or twice a year in the Staves. The Merchant Council's way of showing the gamblers, procurers, and performers that no matter how much money they poured into the city's coffers, the government was still in charge. He had signaled Matthias and waited. Kaz had been clear. Vanek won't act unless he has Alice back and out of harm's way. That's when we need to keep sharp. And sure enough, once Alice and Inej had traded places, some kind of ruckus had started on the bridge. Jesper's trigger finger itched, but his second job had been simple too. Watch Kaz for the sign. Seconds later, Kaz's cane shot into the air, and he and Inej were hurtling over the bridge railing. Jesper struck a match, and 1, 2, 3, 4... 5 of the rockets Weiland had prepared were screaming toward the sky. exploding in crackling bursts of color. The last was a shimmer of pink. Strontium chloride, Weiland had told him. Working away on his collection of fireworks and explosives, flash bombs, weevils, and whatever else was needed. In the dark, it burns red. Things are always more interesting in the dark, Jesper had replied. He hadn't been able to help it. Really, if the Merchling was going to offer those kinds of opportunities, he had a duty to take them. The first batch of fireworks was a signal to the Mr. Crimsons whom Nina and Matthias had recruited last night, or very early this morning, offering free food and wine to anyone who came to Godmed Bridge when the fireworks went off just after noon. All a big promotion for the non-existent Crimson Cutlass. Knowing only a fraction of the people would actually show up, they'd given away more than 200 costumes and bags of fake coins. If we get 50, it will be enough, said Kaz. Never underestimate the public's desire to get something for nothing. Jesper figured there had to be at least 100 Mr. Crimsons flooding the bridge and the stave, singing the chant that accompanied his entrance in any of the Comédie Brute plays, tossing coins into the air. Sometimes the coins were real. It was why he was a crowd favorite. People were laughing, whirling each other around, grabbing for coins, chasing after the Mr. Crimsons as the Stodwatch tried in vain to keep order. It was glorious. Jesper knew the money was fake, but he would have loved to be down there scrambling for silver anyway. He had to keep still a little while longer. If the bombs Weiland had planted in the canal didn't go off when they were supposed to, Kaz and Inej were going to need a lot more cover to get off the flower seller's boat. A series of glittering booms exploded across the sky. Matthias had released the second batch of fireworks. These weren't a signal. They were camouflage. Far below, Jesper saw two huge gouts of water spurt up from the canal as Weiland detonated his water mines. Right on time, Merchling. Now, he stowed his rifle beneath his Mr. Crimson cloak and descended the stairs, stopping only to join Nina as they raced out of the hotel. They'd marked each of their red and white masks with a large black tear to make sure they'd be able to tell one another apart from the other revelers. But in the midst of the melee, Jesper wondered if they should have chosen something more conspicuous. As they sped across the bridge, Jesper thought he spotted Matthias and Weiland in their red capes, tossing coins as they steadily made their way off the stave. If they started running, it might draw Stadwatch attention. Jesper struggled not to laugh. That was definitely Matthias and Weiland. Matthias was hurling the money with way too much force, and Weiland with way too much enthusiasm. The kid's throwing arm needed serious work. It looked like he was actively trying to dislocate his shoulder. From here, they'd go separate directions, each through a different alley or canal that led off the stave, discarding their Mr. Crimson costumes for other Comédie Brute characters and disguises. They were to wait for sunset before they returned to Black Vale. Plenty of time to get into trouble. Jesper could feel the pull of East Stave. He could wend his way there, find a card game, spend a few hours at Three-Man Bramble. Kaz wouldn't like it. Jesper was too well known. It was one thing to play at the Cumulus in a private parlor as part of a job. This would be something different. Kaz had vanished with promises of a huge haul and several valued members of the dregs. People were speculating wildly about where he'd gone, and Rotti had said Pear Haskell was looking for all of them. Stodwatch officers would probably be visiting the slat tonight to ask a lot of uncomfortable questions, and There was Pekka Rollins to worry about, too. Just a couple of hands, Jesper promised himself. Enough to scratch the itch. Then I'll go visit Da. Jesper's stomach turned at that. He wasn't ready to face his father alone, just yet. To tell him the truth of all this madness. Suddenly, the need to be at the tables was overwhelming. To hell with not running. Since Kaz hadn't obliged him with something to shoot at, Jesper needed a pair of dice and long odds to clear his mind. That was when the world went white. The sound was something between a thunderbolt and a lightning crack. It lifted Jesper off his feet, sent him sprawling as a roaring whoosh filled his ears. He was suddenly lost in a storm of white smoke and dust that clogged his lungs. He coughed, and whatever he'd inhaled grated against the lining of his throat as if the air had turned into finely powdered glass. His eyelids were coated in grit, and he fought not to rub at them, blinking rapidly, trying to dislodge bits of debris. He pushed himself up to his hands and knees, gasping for air, head ringing. Another Mr. Crimson lay on the ground beside him, a black tear painted onto his red lacquer cheek. Jesper dislodged the mask. Nina's eyes were closed, and blood ran from her temple. He shook her shoulder. Nina! He shouted, above the screams and wailing around him. Her eyes fluttered open as she drew a sharp breath, then started coughing as she sat up.
What was that? What happened?
I don't know, said Jesper. But someone other than Weiland is setting off bombs. Look. A huge black hole gaped in front of the house of the White Rose. A bed hung precariously from the second floor, ready to collapse into the lobby. The rose vines that climbed the front of the house had caught fire, and a heavy perfume had risen in the air. From somewhere inside, they could hear shouting.
Oh, saints! I have to help them, Nina said.
And Jesper's addled mind remembered that she'd worked at the White Rose for the better part of a year.
Where's Matthias?
She asked, eyes searching the crowd.
Where's Weiland?
If this is one of Kaz's surprises... I don't think... Jesper began. Then another boom shook the cobblestones. They flattened themselves on the ground, arms thrown over their heads.
What in the name of every saint who suffered is going on?
Nina yelled in fear and exasperation. People were shrieking and running all around them, trying to find some kind of shelter. She pulled herself to her feet and peered south down the canal toward the plume of smoke rising from another of the pleasure houses.
Is it the Willow Switch?
No, said Nina, an expression of horror dawning on her face as she came to some realization Jesper didn't understand.
It's the anvil.
As she said it, a shape shot skyward from the hole in the side of what had been the anvil. It soared toward them in a blur.
Grisha, said Jesper.
They must have Parim. But the shape zoomed overhead, and they twisted their necks to follow its progress. Jesper saw he was very wrong, or he'd completely lost his mind. It wasn't a squalor flying above them. It was a man with wings. Huge metallic things that moved in a hummingbird whir. He had someone clutched in his arms. A boy, screaming in what sounded like Ravkin.
Did you see that?
Tell me you saw that, said Jesper.
It's Markov, Nina said, the fear and anger clear on her face.
That's why they targeted the anvil.
Nina! Matthias was striding across the bridge, Weiland at his heels. Both of them had their masks shoved atop their heads, but the Stadtwatch had to have bigger concerns right now.
We have to get out of here, Matthias said. If Van Eck...
But Nina grabbed his arm.
That was Donal Markov. He worked at the anvil.
The guy with wings?
Asked Jesper.
No, Nina said,
shaking her head frantically. The captive! Markov is an Inferni. She pointed down the canal. They hit the anvil? The House of the White Rose? They're hunting Grisha. They're looking for me. At that moment, a second winged figure burst from the White Rose. Another boom sounded, and as the lower wall caved in, a huge man and woman strode forward. They had black hair and bronze skin, just like the men with wings. "Shoo," said Jesper. "What are they doing here? And since when do they fly?"
"Masks down," said Matthias. "We need to get to safety." They slid their masks into place. Jesper felt grateful for the uproar surrounding them. But even as he had the thought, one of the shoe men sniffed the air. A deep inhale. In horror, Jesper watched him turn slowly and lock eyes on them. He barked something to his companions, and then the shoe were headed straight for them. "Too late," said Jesper. He tore off his mask and cape and shouldered his rifle. "If they came looking for fun, let's give them some. I'll take the flyer." Jesper had no intention of getting swept up by some kind of shoe bird boy. He didn't know where the second flyer had gone, and could only hope he was occupied with his Inferni captive. The winged man darted left, right, swooping and zooming like a drunken honeybee. "Stay still, you big bug," Jesper grunted, then squeezed off three shots that struck the flyer's chest dead center, flinging him backward. But the flyer righted himself in a graceful somersault and sped toward Jesper. Matthias was blasting away at the two huge shoe. Every shot was a direct hit. But though the shoe stumbled, they just kept coming.
"Wylan, Nina," said Jesper. "Anytime you want to jump in, feel free."
"I'm trying," Nina growled, hands raised, fist clenched.
"They're not feeling it."
"Get down," said Wylan. They dropped to the cobblestones. Jesper heard a thunk, and then saw a black blur as something hurtled at the winged man. The flyer dodged left, but the black blur split and two crackling balls of violet flame exploded. One landed with a harmless hiss in the canal water. The other struck the flyer. He screamed, clawing at himself as violet flames spread over his body and wings, then careened off course and slammed into a wall, the flames still burning, their heat palpable even from a distance.
"Run!" Matthias yelled.
They bolted for the nearest alley, Jesper and Wylan in the lead, Nina and Matthias on their heels. Wylan tossed a flash bomb recklessly over his shoulder. It smashed through a window and released a burst of useless brilliance.
"You probably just scared the hell out of some hapless working girl," Jesper said. "Give me that."
He snatched the other flash bomb and lobbed it directly into the path of their pursuers, turning to protect his eyes from the explosion. "And that's how it's done."
"Next time, I'm not saving your life,"
Wylan panted.
"You'd miss me. Everyone does,"
Nina cried out. Jesper turned. Nina's thrashing body was covered in silver netting, and she was being dragged backward by the shoe woman, who stood with legs planted in the center of the alley. Matthias opened fire, but she didn't budge.
"Bullets don't work," Wylan said. "I think there's metal beneath their skin."
Now that he said it, Jesper could see metal glinting from under the bloody bullet wounds. But what did that mean? Were they mechanicals of some sort? How was it possible?
"The net," Matthias roared.
They all grabbed hold of the metal net, trying to pull Nina to safety. But the shoe woman kept yanking her backward, hand over hand, with impossible strength.
"We need something to cut the cord," Jesper shouted.
"To hell with the cord," Nina snarled beneath gritted teeth. She snatched a revolver from Jesper's holster.
"Let go,"
she commanded.
Nina, protested Matthias. Do it!
They let go, and Nina zipped down the alley in a sudden burst of momentum. The shoe woman took an awkward step back, then seized the edge of the net, yanking Nina up. Nina waited until the last possible second, then said,
Let's see if you're metal all the way through.
She shoved the revolver directly into the shoe woman's eye socket and squeezed the trigger. The blast didn't just take her eye, but most of the top of her skull. For a moment, she still stood, clutching Nina, a gaping mess of bone, soft pink brain matter, and shards of metal where the rest of her face should have been. Then she crumpled. Nina gagged and scrabbled at the net.
Get me out of this thing before her friend comes looking for us.
Matthias tore the net away from Nina, and they all ran, hearts hammering, boots pounding over the cobblestones. Jesper could hear his father's fearful words, hastening him through the streets, a wind of warning at his back.
I'm afraid for you. The world can be cruel to your kind.
What had the shoe sent after Nina? After the city's Grisha? After him? Jesper's existence had been a string of close calls and near disasters. But he'd never been so sure he was running for his life.
Part 3. Brick by Brick. 11. Inej. As Inej and Kaz moved farther from West Stave, the silence between them spread like a stain. They'd abandoned their capes and masks in a rubbish heap behind a run-down little brothel called the Velvet Room, where Kaz had apparently stashed another change of clothes for them. It was as if the whole city had become their wardrobe, and Inej couldn't help but think of the conjurers who drew miles of scarves from their sleeves and vanished girls from boxes that always reminded her uncomfortably of coffins. Dressed in the bulky coats and rough-spun trousers of dock workers, they made their way into the warehouse district, hair covered by hats, collars pulled up, despite the warm weather. The eastern edge of the district was like a city within a city, populated mostly by immigrants who lived in cheap hotels and rooming houses, or in shantytowns of plywood and corrugated tin, segregating themselves into ramshackle neighborhoods by language and nationality. At this time of day, most of the area's denizens were at work in the city's factories and docks. But on certain corners, Inej saw men and women gathered, hoping some foreman or boss would come along to offer a lucky few of them a day's work. After she'd been freed from the menagerie, Inej had wandered the streets of Ketterdam, trying to make sense of the city. She'd been overwhelmed by the noise and the crowds, certain that Tante Helene or one of her henchmen would catch her unawares and drag her back to the House of Exotics. But she knew that if she was going to be useful to the dregs and earn her way out of her new contract, she couldn't let the strangeness of the clamor and cobblestones best her. We greet the unexpected visitor. She would have to learn the city. She always preferred to travel along the rooftops, out of sight, free from the shuffle of bodies. There she felt most herself again, the girl she'd once been, someone who hadn't the sense to be afraid, who hadn't known what cruelty the world could offer. She'd gotten to know the gabled peaks and window boxes of the Zilverstraat, the gardens and wide boulevards of the embassy sector. She'd traveled far south to where the manufacturing district gave way to foul-smelling slaughterhouses and brining pits, hidden at the very outskirts of the city, where their offal could be sluiced into the swamp at Ketterdam's edge, and their stink was less likely to be sent wafting over the residential parts of town. The city had revealed its secrets to her almost shyly, in flashes of grandeur and squalor. Now she and Kaz left the rooming houses and the street carts behind, plunging deeper into the busy warehouse district, and the area known as the Weft. Here the streets and canals were clean and orderly, kept wide for the transportation of goods and cargo. They passed fenced-in acres of raw lumber and quarried stone, closely guarded stockpiles of weapons and ammunition, huge storehouses brimming with cotton, silk, canvas, and furs, and warehouses packed with the carefully weighed bundles of dried jerda leaves from Novia Zem that would be processed and packaged into tins with bright labels.